Hello, everybody. Dr. Ben Edwards here. Welcome to another episode of You're the Cure. Super excited today to have a guest on the show. And I don't want to stress people out. I mean, stress is our number one enemy. That cortisol spike from stress is the number one, in my opinion, most detrimental thing to our health. And today's topic is going to stress some of y'all out, I'm afraid. And partly that's me to blame. And I'm going to take full responsibility for this. Veritas Medical has been around for about 10 years, and those first 3 or 4 years, based off my initial mentor that got me into this, we were promoting a pretty low-carb, low-glycemic diet, pretty balanced. Then we went more towards just caveman, meat and veggies, kind of some ketogenic, occasionally carnivore, threw in some intermittent fasting. Sometimes what we learned was it was too much, too long. We've had to come around kind of full circle. So today's guest, Georgie Dinkoff, I think I can say that maybe he single-handedly moved Dr. Joe Mercola off the ketogenic diet into a more balanced or even higher carb diet, you might say. I was listening to a recent interview Georgie was on with Dr. Mercola, and Dr. Mercola stated his diet used to be, and everyone knows Dr. Mercola, and he was ketogenic king. He wrote a book called Fat for Fuel. I think he was about 80% fat in his diet. And then he flipped it after his first interview with Georgie. He flipped it down to about a mid 20% fat in the diet. Started eating like 200 carbs instead of 40. Lost 5 pounds. Fasting blood sugar dropped 10 points. So if you can get Dr. Joe Mercola to flip his mind, and I would say just continue traveling down this journey of knowledge that we're all on. That's pretty impressive. So, and that's what our guest did. And so we're going to bring Georgie on in a minute, but I want to say first that little caveat here. We're talking today about using food as medicine, basically. We're trying to use a specific kind of eating pattern or plan to, I would say, kind of force or micromanage or encourage the biochemistry and the mitochondria to do a certain thing for us. And we're pretty notorious for historically doing this as nutrition-minded physicians, whether that's using vegan, vegetarian, you could do that short term and see some benefit. You could do juicing fast, water fast, carnivore, keto, intermittent fasting, all of these, even the calories in, calories out, you know, Weight Watchers program, low fat back in the day. You can see some short-term benefit on all those, I would say, to a degree. But what's the long-term negative? And that's what we've run into with some of our patients in particular over the past couple of years, as we've seen that low-carb keto intermittent fasting that we highly recommended for many years. We saw particularly in women, but not just women, some negatives to that, such as the metabolism tanks, and these ladies get cold intolerant. Their hair falls out. Their hormones get all out of whack. Their mood changes. Sleep is off, and actually start gaining weight again. So there can be some negative long-term impacts, and we're going to talk about that today. But I want to state the lessons I've learned over the past 10 years, and I think I've stated these before, and I don't think any diet's going to fix your weight problems, your metabolic issues, if you have not learned how to maintain and sustain muscle mass. That's lesson number one. Lesson number two, I would say, is you've got to have good sleep. If you don't have good sleep, that throws everything off. Lesson number three, you can't be in a chronic state of fight or flight psychologically. That cortisol effect will disrupt everything. So I want to state that before we get into food and carbs and sugar and this and that and what's good and what's bad and what's Georgie seeing and recommending and his personal experience and all the science, I want to just say that before you go down another nutrition rabbit hole or diet rabbit hole, maybe that's the wrong term, but I want to just state clearly, muscle mass, good sleep. You can throw sunshine in there, I think, Dr. Jack Cruz and his protocols on sunshine, and peace. Not being in a state of stress all the time. If you cannot expect diet to fix all your problems if you're not sleeping, you're chronically stressed out, and you're not maintaining muscle mass. That's my opinion. We'll see what Georgie has to say about it. So I'd just like to put that out there. We talk about the four pillars: nutrition, hydration, movement, and peace. And historically, patients tend to just gravitate to the nutrition pillar, and they want to fix all their problems with diet, nutrition. And you can get a lot done with nutrition. We don't need to ignore that, obviously, but those other three pillars are so important. So just want to say that before we get into this and rock some people's worlds when we advise you can actually eat some sugar. It's not the devil. So Georgie, little intro there. You might want to comment on that. Before you jump in, though, just a little background. Maybe I've never interviewed Ray Pete. I know he's passed on. He was a mentor of yours. So maybe a little on Ray Pete and just your own personal journey of how did you get to where you are today?
Sure. Well, I think if there is such a thing as a Ray Pete diet, you can call it a pro-metabolic diet. This is probably one of the biggest proponents of keeping the basal metabolic rate as high as possible. There are some other schools in nutrition which don't recommend keeping the metabolic rate as high. They're citing some studies showing potentially negative correlations between levels of free T3. I want to stress that it's the free T3 and longevity. However, this kind of, is based on the premise that it's the free steroid that is active. But lately, I think medicine is kind of trying to shift away from that concept because there's plenty of evidence that it's the total levels of T3 that really matter. It's the same thing as the total levels of testosterone, because those are the numbers that indicate the functioning of your thyroid gland. Mm-hmm. So basically, Dr. Pete is saying, eat a diet that maximizes the production of total T3 in the body. Most of the actually T3 is produced in the liver from T4, which is produced from the thyroid. Most of it is produced in the thyroid. So Dr. Pete's diet basically says, avoid things that suppress the thyroid, dietary or lifestyle-wise, and conversely, eat things and do things that promote the function of the thyroid gland. And it's really the thyroid gland that kind of keeps everything in balance. Mm-hmm. When the thyroid gland is not working, because that is the primary conductor, the thyroid gland, of our metabolic functioning, obviously if cells are completely non-metabolic, they die. So complete lack of metabolism equals death. And in order for the body to prevent from that from happening, when thyroid is not working, we have an emergency mechanism, which you kind of alluded to, which is the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, also known as the fight or flight response. And when your thyroid is not working, in other words, when your metabolic rate is not high through the optimal means, which means through thyroid, the body activates the stress response because it says something is wrong. Whether it's improper diet or lack of sleep or chronic stress, chronic threats from the outside, whatever that is, I need to keep you alive. And since you're not giving me the optimal environment and food and or food, I'm going to do the best I can with the limited resources that I have here, which means I'm going to elevate cortisol, and cortisol is going to shred predominantly your lean muscle tissue and then connective tissue and then skin and bone and brain and everything, really. Basically, the body will consume itself unless you provide it with the optimal resources. And that is that we see at the extreme level of that hyper-stress response, a phenomenon called cachexia, which is seen in people with advanced cancer, with advanced type uncontrolled type 1 diabetes, various other wasting conditions. Basically, eventually they die from that wasting condition. The body simply consumes itself. Mm-hmm. And a lot of a lot of that wasting process is driven by cortisol. It has been known since the early 20th century that one can reproduce all of the phenotypes of aging in an animal. Well, obviously, human studies have not been done yet for ethical reasons, but there's some observations too that you can produce all the signs of aging prematurely by simply elevating cortisol, way more than it optimally needs to, and also chronically. Okay. Cortisol is not supposed to be high chronically; it's supposed to have a sort of like an acute response, and then it's supposed to decline. So, literally, Pete is saying, eat the right type of diet that keeps thyroid function high, which is going to ensure that the HPA, the hypothalamus pituitary axis, the stress response, will be kept at bay. Now, you're always going to have some stress response, and that's a good thing. You don't want to be basically not being able to muster up the cortisol response when there's an acute stressor in your environment. That is very important to be able to respond to that, and that's how young, healthy people do it. But the follow-up to that is, once the threat is gone, then the cortisol is supposed to go back to normal or to baseline, because if it doesn't, then you're asking for all kinds of trouble, and over time, it can generate a lot of chronic conditions. Most doctors are familiar with the effects of cortisol on obesity, diabetes, depression, But it cardiovascular disease, but it can actually cause pretty much any chronic condition. It can cause immunosuppressions. You can potentially die from a viral or bacterial infection. So really, cortisol needs to basically be kept at bay. And that's the function of the thyroid. So that's repeat work. It revolves around thyroid in general, keeping the metabolic rate high so that we produce sufficient amounts of ATP and carbon dioxide through oxidative phosphorylation. In other words, by oxidizing nutrients through consuming oxygen. Conversely, when you're under stress, you're actually still converting things to energy, but you're doing it through a lot less efficient process known as glycolysis, which is fermentation, and/or through fatty acid oxidation, which a lot of people think is a good thing, but it's actually the evolutionary purpose of fatty acid oxidation is basically a stress signal. You know, it means that you don't have sufficient access to good, high quality food. So the body taps into its reserves. And that is a signal for the body that it needs to actually compensate and balance and trade off by turning off a lot of other functions that are highly energetically expensive. And since the body doesn't have the proper amount of glucose, which is what it prefers to oxidize for optimal metabolism, then the body will turn off a lot of other functions, such as, you know, reproductive function, cognitive function, mood, skin quality, hair quality. You already mentioned it, that you're seeing a lot of these women going on a low-carb diet for a long time, that eventually these problems manifest. And it's completely normal, and it's been seen in nature too. There's a study that I posted a couple of years ago on my blog, which showed that the hibernating animals, they gorge themselves up on food during the warm months of the year, and during that time, their health is perfect. And then once they start hibernating, they actually, because of that, they're not eating anymore, they tap into their fat resources. Once they start getting predominantly fat, they meet all of the diagnostic criteria for diabetes. And they stay diabetic while they're hibernating because they're not eating, which is kind of like a surrogate for a low-carb diet or chronic fasting or even intermittent fasting. Also surrogate for stress, because when you're under stress, when cortisol rises, it increases the level of fatty acid oxidation and suppresses the oxidation of glucose. So basically, it shows that, you know, when you're oxidizing fat, it is a sign for the organism that things are not optimal. So the organism is going to compensate and turn off a lot of things that are considered non-essential for survival. Yet those things are exactly what makes life worth living, right? Who wants to feel cold all the time, or have a brain fog all the time, or not enjoy life, you know, anymore, and sort of kind of like, you know, stumble through the day and wait for the next day to come? Nobody likes that kind of life. And I think most doctors would agree that it's not a sign of good health. Right. Well, that's what stress and or excessive fatty oxidation do. And ultimately, this is tied to a lowering of the metabolic rate. Conversely, when you're oxidizing primarily glucose, basically a lot of good things happen in the body. And it just so happens that glucose and fatty acids compete for access to the metabolic machinery that we have, so that the cell at any point in time can oxidize primarily one of those, but not both at the same time. So if you're oxidizing predominantly fatty acids, you're going to be oxidizing very little glucose. Conversely, if you're oxidizing predominantly glucose, you'll be oxidizing fewer fatty acids. And again, Dr. Pete's theory, by keeping the metabolic rate high and providing plenty of glucose, kind of ensures that the oxidation of fat is kept to a minimum, and the fats are used as fuel primarily by the muscles, which you mentioned earlier in the intro. Most of your muscles, including the heart, prefer to oxidize fats at rest. The process of oxidation of fats is slower, and that's why the muscles prefer to do it at rest. They can consume a tremendous amount of fat, which is why it's the proper way to lose weight is actually to keep your muscle mass and actually even increase it. That's another kind of sort of like a tenet of Dr. Pete's teachings, is that you want to build muscle mass, or at least prevent the loss of muscle mass that happens with aging. Well, it just so happens that cortisol happens to be the most catabolic hormone that we have for our muscles. So another reason to keep stress down, keep fatty acid oxidation at bay, keep glucose oxidation high. So that is kind of like the gist of Dr. Pete's theory, and it also ties a lot of the hormones. Cortisol is a non-catabolic hormone, but cortisol never acts in isolation. Whenever cortisol is released, it usually, after about 10 minutes of elevated cortisol, adrenaline is also released, which increases lipolysis and contributes to the fatty acid oxidation. Cortisol activates an enzyme known as aromatase, which synthesizes estrogen. So estrogen will start to get synthesized. A lot of people think of estrogen as a female hormone, but that's not true. Both men and women produce it. And in fact, aging males can actually produce a lot more estrogen than even menopausal women. And in fact, most of the symptoms that we know as the aging male, such as, you know, saggy skin, central obesity, loss of hair, gynecomastia, poor libido, infertility, even cancer, are actually now known to be driven primarily by estrogen in males. And the same thing actually happens in females. And Dr. Pete's research shows that basically every disorder in the body can be viewed as an endocrine disorder. In other words, it's a systemic disease, which ultimately stems from low metabolism, but is directly manifested by some of the other more directly acting hormones, such as estrogen, cortisol, adrenaline, serotonin, parathyroid hormone. All of these are things that basically mimic the stress response, suppress the oxidation of glucose, increase the oxidation of fat, and promotes the inflammatory process. Speaking of inflammation, another central tenet of the bioenergetic theory is that since we need to avoid metabolic inhibitors in our environment, one of the strongest and most ubiquitous metabolic inhibitors are the polyunsaturated fats. That's probably where Dr. Pete clashes the most with mainstream medical dogma. Everything that else that he says is actually widely accepted, maybe not accepted to the point of his synthesis saying that things tie together in this specific way. But, you know, if Dr. Pete says, hey, estrogen can cause cancer, most doctors will probably nod in agreement and say, yeah, sure, under certain circumstances, that's true. However, when it gets to the point of saying that, you know, listen, really eating a lot of polyunsaturated fats, in fact, they're present everywhere in every commercial food, so because they're so cheap and they're produced by the agricultural industry and they're heavily subsidized. But these polyunsaturated fatty acids with two or more double bonds are very, very strong metabolic inhibitors. They directly inhibit the synthesis of thyroid from the thyroid gland. And for second, they're also easily peroxidizable, and most of their peroxidizable byproducts are actually toxic aldehydes that are known carcinogens. And third, even when they're properly metabolized through several enzymes such as cyclooxygenase and lipoxygenase, the polyunsaturated fats generate these highly inflammatory mediators, which are known and accepted even by mainstream medicine to be very, very detrimental to health. In fact, drugs, some of the most successful drugs on the market currently, are inhibitors of these enzymes, cyclooxygenase and lipoxygenase, also known as COX and LOX, and aspirin is one of them. But virtually all of the so-called NSAID drugs, non-steroid anti-inflammatory drugs, are inhibitors at one or both of these pathways. So Dr. Pete said, look, it's clear that if you eat a lot of PUFA, you're going to have a lot of inflammation. How about instead of taking these drugs that are kind of working downstream of the picture, of where the problem really starts, how about we simply don't consume this PUFA to start with? Unfortunately, back in the 1930s, there was a single study, and I emphasize a single study, that somehow came up with the claim that polyunsaturated fatty acids are essential. In other words, we have to eat them or we die. This has never been replicated, and it has never been proven in humans. This is based on only one study, the Burr and Burr study, husband and wife, I think published it in 1932. And they basically demonstrated that if you deprive rats of linoleic and linolenic acid, basically they start to develop skin problems, and they look frail and fragile, and you know they kind of look sick. And when you give them back the linoleic or linolenic acid, then all these symptoms disappear. However, subsequent studies demonstrated that these symptoms that they saw in the rats are simply the result of drastically increased metabolic rate, up to 70%, almost doubling. And actually, when you have a metabolic rate that high, keeping the rats from that original diet, which is meant for normal metabolic, but I would call them hypometabolic rats with low metabolism because they're eating a lot of PUFA, when you increase the metabolic rate almost twice as high, then you're also increasing the need for a lot of cofactors, specifically the B vitamins, which were not provided in the diet. The researchers simply deprived the rats of PUFA, the metabolic rate skyrocketed, and then they started getting deficient into a lot of the cofactors. Subsequent studies isolatedly has demonstrated that providing extra zinc or extra biotin, which is a B vitamin, I think B7, or vitamin B3, niacinamide, can alleviate a lot of these visible signs of so-called essential fatty acid deficiency. In other words, that you can completely avoid eating these fatty acids and you'll be still be very good health. Your metabolic rate will be very, very high. You will probably be able to consume 2 to 3 times the amount of calories that you're consuming now and still not gain weight. And also another thing that subsequent studies demonstrated that rats that are so-called essential fatty acid deficient, not just rats, any animal organism, are remarkably resilient to stress, to toxins, to radiation, to disease. In fact, it's impossible to make these rats develop cancer. They never die of cardiovascular disease. Basically, their lifespan is extended almost by at least, I think 50%, the maximum lifespan, while the average lifespan is extended by at least as much. So really, a lot of good things happen when you avoid the metabolic inhibitors and keep the metabolic rate high. And of course, there are many ways to do that. But the central message of Ray Peet's theory, the bioenergetic theory, is do all of these things as you mentioned in the context of keep the metabolic rate high, avoid stress, right? Eat the right diet by avoiding these polyunsaturated fats, and there's some other additional criteria that are there, and consume sufficient amounts of glucose. Because if you don't consume sufficient amounts of glucose, your body will get the glucose that it needs. And since it's not coming from the outside, it will come from the inside, which means cortisol will rise adaptively, and you're going to start losing lean muscle tissue, which is the worst thing possible as a result of dieting. There's even a medical term for it. It's called sarcopenic obesity. So in other words, loss of muscle mass in the context of maintained fat mass. It's the worst possible outcome. It's better to be obese with large muscles than to be sarcopenically obese. Even though the sarcopenically obese person may be, their total body weight or body mass index may be lower than the person with a higher BMI that has higher muscle mass. But that person who has sarcopenic obesity will be in a much worse state of health. And that has been confirmed by a recent human study called The Biggest Loser. It was based on that show on TV where they had morbidly obese people go to tremendous exercise of caloric restriction, almost complete carbohydrate avoidance, really grueling exercise regimen. And yes, these people did lose the weight. However, all of them complained that they felt like they're about to die any minute. Their mood was terrible. They were irritable. They were getting into physical fights. A lot of them started developing signs of overt cardiovascular disease that they didn't have before. And then eventually when they lost the weight and dropped out of the show, they won their award. And then they found out that within 6 months, even maintaining a restricted caloric diet, which they were doing during the show, they actually started gaining the weight again. So in other words, and all of them regained and even exceeded the original weight on a caloric intake that was half of what they used to eat before. So they got themselves in the sarcopenic obesity state, which is terrible. It's really bad because now they lost the muscle mass due to the diet and exercising, but they maintained the fat, or at least regained the fat after stopping the show. So now they have basically very low basal metabolic rate, and they can get fat. I mean, they can look huge, but still get fat on a really, really low caloric diet, 700 to 800 calories a day, which sounds extreme. But the same thing was noticed in the survivors of the Holocaust. When they were released from the camps, these people, a lot of them actually died from the so-called refeeding syndrome because they were starved for so long. When they gave them free access to food, the quick eating caused a stress response, and basically a lot of these people died. The ones that didn't developed extreme obesity, even on a very low-calorie diet, and that was because due to the extensive fasting and the torture they endured, they're basically the thyroid gland was completely shot, and they could get fat even on 200 calories a day. I know it sounds ridiculous, but it is certainly possible. Yeah. Needless to say that they were very much alive, other than in the physiological sense.
Right.
They had tremendous cognitive problems, mood problems. A lot of them committed suicide. So all of this can be tied ultimately to low metabolic rate. The brain consumes about 40% of the energy in the body. Even a small drop of efficiency in ATP synthesis, which happens if you restrict glucose or increase fatty acid oxidation or put the body in stress, immediately puts the brain in a stress state. And one of the first signs that you're becoming energetically deficient is souring up of the mood. So a mild, which is considered 10 to 15% drop of ATP levels in the brain, which is the energetic molecule, the biomarker of how well our metabolism is working, 10 to 15% can cause severe irritability. 15 to 20% can cause basically anger and outbursts. 20 to 25 can cause aggression overt. And then over that, basically people become homicidal. This has been confirmed in every single animal model tested and has been also been shown to work as well in people. So that's really the goal of the Ray Peet theory. It's all of this based on published peer-reviewed research, None of it is alternative medicine, even though a lot of people try to claim it is. All it says that it is that energy is paramount, not only for our functioning, but also for our structure. So the analogy that I can give is with the car. Current allopathic medicine, which is the mainstream medicine, says, okay, let's say you're driving, a Ford, and then it's a brand new car, and then you start driving that car, and over time, this car will start breaking down. However, whether the car breaks down or not and how long it takes is completely unrelated to the type of fuel you use. In other words, put whatever fuel you want, as long as it's one of the standard fuels that's available at the gas stations, the Ford will probably not care and keep running until it starts to wear down and break down. Metabolic theory says, basically allopathic medicine says the same thing is true of the body. As long as you're providing the sufficient calories that are needed to maintain, to basically match a specific metabolic rate that a person has, then whether you develop a disease or not is not tied in any way to this caloric intake or to the type of food you're eating. Now, this has lately started to change, but medicine is still very much of the opinion that, look, if you have a structural problem, it's probably something in your genes. Yeah, maybe an interplay between the genes and the environment, but ultimately the genes have to be there in order for you to be susceptible to a specific problem. And if you go to a doctor and you have some kind of a complaint, the doctor will do everything possible to investigate and find a structural problem. And if one isn't found, then medicine kind of like sort of gives up and says, okay, it's a functional issue. We're going to monitor you. We're going to do watchful waiting. But until it manifests into a structural issue, we don't know what to do with it because simply we don't know what's causing it. Metabolic theory says the human body is not like a car. The amount of energy you produce and the sources from which you produce it determines everything that happens in the body, both your function and your structure. Simply because the cells, unlike a car, the cells are alive and the cells are basically maintaining themselves all the time. Every effort the cell makes, just like we do as an organism as a whole, it consumes energy. So clearly, the availability or the abundance of energy is a prerequisite for the cell to be capable of doing its proper job of maintaining itself. So once again, going back to the same statement, the original one is that make sure you produce as much energy as possible. In other words, higher metabolic rate is better as long as it's basically driven by thyroid hormone, the active thyroid hormone called T3, triiodothyronine. And most of the energy that we produce is produced from glucose and not so much from fatty acids.
Okay, so let me summarize real quick. Basically, if you burn sugar, you're going to promote thyroid function and metabolism. If you burn fat, you're going to inhibit thyroid function and metabolism, in a nutshell. And that's going to trigger cortisol, which shreds the body. I don't know if y'all caught that. Shreds the muscle, shreds the brain, shreds the soft tissues. In sarcopenia, for those that don't know, that's when your muscle wasting, your muscle mass goes away. You don't want that. So that's in a nutshell. And then the PUFAs, that's those vegetable oils, the seed oils that we had Dr. Chris Kenobi on a few weeks ago talking about. So in a nutshell, you avoid the PUFAs. You want to burn sugar to promote thyroid, and too much fat burn will inhibit the thyroid, especially long-term. When we come back from the break, we're going to ask Georgie about, does he ever see, because we've seen clinically benefit of ketogenic diet in the short term, a lot of benefits as far as weight loss, A1Cs drop, inflammatory markers drop, stuff like that in the short term. Already talked about the long term. So we're going to talk to Georgie when we get back from the break. Does he ever see a benefit for burning fat for fuel? And also, what would he do clinically if a Biggest Loser showed up, in his office and asked him, and they were sarcopenic, so obese, lost their muscle mass, low metabolic rate, can't eat more than 600 calories, and they still gain weight, what would he do to turn that around? So when we come back from the break, guys, we will get into some of those practical clinical questions. Georgie, what's the best place for people to follow you, read your blog, or just your website? What's the best place to find you?
Yeah, I just have a blog, and that blog, whatever I post on the blog, feeds into Twitter. And my alias online is HeyDude, H as in Harry, A-I, D as in dog, U, T as in Tom, .me. So HeyDude.me is the blog. And then you can either read that or you can go to twitter.com/HeyDude, same alias. And basically that the blog feeds into the Twitter. And of course, when people see the articles, they comment on Twitter and I often engage with them. So Twitter is probably the best way to, get in touch with me.
Okay. Guys, we'll be right back. I'm talking to Georgie Dinkoff today. Dr. Ben Edwards, you're the cure. Stick with us. We'll be back in a second. Okay, everybody, we are back. Got Georgie Dinkoff on the show today. I asked him one question, and that took the whole first half of the show. So I've got to pick my second question wisely, Georgie. And I let it into this. Would you ever see, because clinically, like I said, we see some benefit. I'll tell you two things. We'll see benefit in the initial phases when people go low carb. Now, part of that's because they're coming off the standard American diet, processed sugar, which is high fructose corn syrup, the vegetable oils, processed grain. So that, you know, that's just not even real food. So that's number one. They're going to benefit just getting off that garbage, pro-inflammatory garbage. But going on a low carb diet, historically, we've seen lab work improve. Long term, we see sometimes it not improve. We've had some practitioners in my clinic start to utilize, or some of the patients start to utilize, a pro-metabolic approach, and maybe not just the right way. And we actually saw an increase in weight and triglycerides and blood sugar. And so maybe speak to that. I think it has to do with the fat content not coming down low enough when they added the sugar back in. So question, would you ever see a benefit or promote a keto type of diet? I know even carnivore diet now, Dr. Paul Saladino is eating carbs. So I totally get it long term. So short term, and then what would you do with a patient that came in with a high insulin, 50 pounds overweight, that low metabolic rate? Would you start with muscle mass work? Would you start with adding the sugar in, and what type of sugar? So we'll try to hit all those topics. The floor is yours.
Couple of things. I just want to draw a little bit of a distinction between the carnivore diet and low carb diets, because a lot of people think that if you're eating meat, you're not consuming any sugar. However, if the meat is fresh, glycogen, which is the primary storage form of sugar in our body, when we eat the sugar, not in excess, but more than they can be immediately oxidized, glycogen is primarily stored in the liver and the muscle tissue. So if you're eating fresh meat, you're actually consuming quite a bit of stored glucose. In fact, it's probably in a ratio of 2-1, up to 3-1 ratio in favor of carbs to the protein. So if you're eating fresh, lean meat, you're actually eating a very decent amount of both protein and even more so carbs.
Okay.
The carnivore diet, now if you're eating aged meat, then the whole thing changes drastically. The glycogen is gone because the bacteria, which is ever present, starts to metabolize and ferment it, and then the meat starts to build up a lot of lactic acid, because that's what the bacteria produces from that glycogen, while also the increased turnover of the bacteria, the gram-negative one, creates a lot of endotoxin. So it's I know a lot of people who love beefsteak, but invariably, even the ones that love the really, really highly aged steaks, which are for some reason the most expensive ones, they don't seem to sit well with them. Basically, it causes digestive disturbances, flushing. Even allergic reactions, like an anaphylactic reaction, they're starting to gasp for air. And I think a lot of that is due to the fact that aged meat basically has lost all of its glycogen, and that glycogen has been replaced by both lactic acid, which is also the D-isomer. D-lactate. It's toxic, but our tissues have problems digesting, because we're evolved to metabolize the L-lactate, which is what we produce. So if you're eating aged meats, you're eating basically a low-carb diet with high protein and a lot of D-lactate and endotoxin. But fresh meat is actually closer to the pro-metabolic diet that Dr. Pete is recommending. Have I ever seen benefit in low-carb diets? Yes, I was on a low-carb diet myself. I was probably one of the first people that got onto the paleo diet back in circa 2009, 2010. And over time, at the advice of my doctor at the time, who was also very much into nutrition, I migrated to an almost completely sugar-free diet. And while I did lose weight initially, I was visiting a gym at the time, and they have these devices where they can measure your muscle mass and your fat mass, and also water content of the body. I noticed that even though the scales dipped, that my total weight declined, neither the fat mass nor the muscle mass changed much initially in the first couple of months. So I was losing primarily water. And this is actually a very well-known effect of the low-carb diet, is that they act a little bit like a diuretic. So you're losing weight, but most of that weight is actually extracellular water. Now, if you continue on this pathway of low-carbing, just as you said, the cortisol rises adaptively, but there are some benefits if most of the fat that you're consuming is saturated fat. And there are even medical usages for such diet, the ketogenic diet, which is used to kind of prepare people that don't respond to epileptic drugs. They're usually children. They put them in a metabolic ward. They feed them a ketogenic diet. But the fat is almost entirely composed of saturated fatty acids and predominantly the short and the medium chain ones. And then they keep them there for maybe 3 months. But even then, I don't think that any of these doctors that is treating epileptic patients with ketogenic diet is recommending this diet for the long term. The goal is always to make the patient sensitize the patient to anti-epileptic drugs so they can discharge from the metabolic ward and they'll spend the rest of their life in a hospital. So once they start responding to the anti-epileptic drugs, they're discharged, they're starting a normal diet, and they're given an anti-epileptic drug. But yes, initially, there is a benefit. And in my opinion, the two biggest factors that contribute to this benefit, the fact that if you're eating primarily a saturated fat, it will, first of all, it has an anti-stress effect. A lot of the saturated fatty acids are basically acting on the pituitary to release, to inhibit its release of the adrenal corticotropin hormone, which is what signals the adrenals to produce cortisol. So saturated fats actually have an anti-stress and anti-cortisol effect. That in and of itself is actually a great effect that will probably calm the person down, allow them to recover some of their sanity and quality of sleep and even metabolic rate, because the cortisol will suppress it if it's elevated. A second benefit is that a lot of the medium and short chain fatty acids, when they get, first of all, many of them are direct agonists or activators of the GABA receptor, which is a sedative, a hypnotic type of receptor. And many of the anti-epileptic drugs are GABA agonists, which immediately explains why the ketogenic diet, specifically with those fatty acids, works for epilepsy. You're just replacing, you know, a pharma GABA agonist with a natural one in the form of these saturated fatty acids, the short and the medium chain fatty acids. But also, activating the GABA system is also known to suppress the fight or flight response system, the HPA axis, while simultaneously removing the brakes on the thyroid to produce T4. In addition, GABA agonists have been shown to stimulate the uptake of cholesterol, which is the precursor of all steroids, the uptake of cholesterol from the blood into the cell and then into the mitochondria, where basically, the long chain, the aliphatic chain of cholesterol is cleaved and you produce pregnenolone and all the downstream steroids from pregnenolone, many of which are very good for us. So GABA agonists act like a steroid kickstarters of the whole steroidogenic cascade, while simultaneously suppressing the synthesis of the stress hormones. So if you remove the stress hormones, but you start producing all the other steroids, you're probably going to get into a hormonal profile that is very similar to what a young person has, which means a high amounts of the anti-cortisol hormones, which are anabolic or at least anti-catabolic, and low amounts of the cortisols, of the aldosterone, which even though directly it's not catabolic, it actually has a very pro-fibrotic effect and it causes heart failure. Some of the oldest drugs on the market for heart failure, like spironolactone, are aldosterone antagonists. So GABA agonists will suppress the cortisol and aldosterone pathway, as well as the estrogenic pathway. So you're going to be left with pregnenolone, progesterone, DHEA, and the androgens, but mostly in males, which is exactly the hormonal profile that we want to see in young people. In males, we want high levels of the prometabolic anti-cortisol precursors like pregnenolone and DHEA, and higher levels of androgens such as testosterone and even dihydrotestosterone. In women, we would like to see higher levels of pregnenolone, progesterone, DHEA. And those are little, if you look at the hormonal profiles of 20 to 25 year old people, that's exactly what we see. But if you look at the hormonal profile of older people, especially over 45 or even 50, all of these so-called youth hormones, the precursors, the anti-cortisol, the anti-estrogenic hormones, they're all gone. They're all down by up to 80%. However, neither the estrogen, nor the cortisol, nor the aldosterone declines. So really, the aging can be viewed as an endocrine problem where the brakes on stress have been removed, have disintegrated, and now the stress hormones rule unopposed, and basically, the body eventually catabolizes itself. So that in a nutshell, is really basically what eating a so-called Western diet, which is really, for me, is a euphemism for a high PUVA, high CETO diet, combined with also high carbs. But if you go on a ketogenic diet, which is based primarily on saturated fats, you're going to be inhibiting a lot of these catabolic pro-inflammatory processes and returning the body towards a more youthful state in terms of hormonal balance, thyroid production, and general state of anti-stress. Unfortunately, because the glucose and saturated fatty, even saturated fatty acids, compete with each other for oxidation, over time, oxidizing primarily fatty acids leads to a so-called state of reduction. So in other words, the body can be either in a state of shifted towards oxidation or reduction. And there are various biomarkers in the body that indicate which side of the spectrum you're on. And one of the best ratios that we have is the mitochondrial ratio of NAD plus to NADH. No matter if you oxidize primarily fat, unfortunately, even saturated fat, the ratio of NAD plus to NADH will drop. In other words, NAD plus is the oxidized cofactor, NADH is the reduced one. So you're going to have relatively more NADH. You'll be shifted more towards reduction. It sounds like simply a functional shift that doesn't really do much damage, but there are multiple studies demonstrating that shifting the body more towards reductive stress starts to produce a large amount of reactive oxygen species. And that's a very bad thing. And even mainstream medicine recognizes this, that reactive oxygen species are dangerous and are probably one of the major factors behind most chronic diseases. So we don't want that. Another thing that happens is that several studies demonstrated that having a reduced state of the mitochondria, in other words, low mitochondrial ratio of NAD to NADH, is sufficient to cause the cell to disintegrate one of its very crucial sort of steps in the whole metabolic pathway known as electron transport chain complex 1. The cell will physically start to disintegrate simply because it's not using it, because the oxidation of fats bypasses complex 1 and goes directly to complex 2. So the cell simply says, okay, if I use it or lose it, if I'm not using it, I'm not going to waste energy on maintaining something I'm not using, so I'm going to get rid of that. So simply a shift in the redox state towards reduction over a period of several days to weeks is sufficient to start causing structural changes in the cell, which if the ketogenic diet is stopped and then you try to oxidize glucose again, glucose certainly needs electron transport chain complex 1, but now it's gone. So for a while, you will be eating all this glucose and it will not get properly metabolized. So the body has to do something with that glucose. And the primary mechanisms, one is to excrete through the urine. Another is to synthesize things like glucuronic acid or cholesterol, or of course, triglycerides and cholesterol, and basically start depositing these into the peripheral tissues, which is probably why you're seeing people that are being on a ketogenic diet for longer periods of time, which is, I would say, more than 6 months, when they stop that and they go directly to a higher carbohydrate diet, then they're starting to see an increase in the triglycerides simply because some of that machinery that is needed to oxidize the glucose is no longer there. Now, that sounds like very bad news. I mean, does that mean that we, irreparably damaged ourselves by eating the ketogenic diet? The good news is it seems that that's not the case. If simply shifting the redox ratio, the mitochondrial redox ratio, back towards oxidation, and there are many ways to do that, one of them is, increasing the metabolic rate, of course, actually makes the cell regenerate complex 1 and start oxidizing glucose again. So yes, there is some potential for real damage to be done by ketogenic diets if they're done long term. In the short term, they are very beneficial. They can be very beneficial if the fat eaten is predominantly saturated fat and of the medium and short chain fatty acids. But over the long period over the long term, 6 months or more, we're starting to see these sort of like structural changes appear that are not going to be predominantly saturated fat. Okay. So things that can be done to reverse that process, that structural change, is increase the levels of NAD+. One way to do it is by taking precursors such as vitamin B3, niacin or niacinamide. Unfortunately, niacin, the one that causes flushing, is probably not very good for taking because it causes liberation of histamine and serotonin from the platelets, and that's what causes a flushing reaction. But longer-term studies have shown that if you give niacin long-term, despite the increase in the good cholesterol, HDL, and potential drop in the so-called bad cholesterol, LDL, that does not translate into improved cardiovascular outcomes. In fact, if you feed niacin, the flushing version, long-term, several studies have demonstrated that there's an increase in the rate of both ischemic and hemorrhaging strokes, like basically the blood clot causing, the stroke caused by blood clots and the stroke caused by simply a blood vessel rupturing in the brain. That's the hemorrhagic one. So niacin is probably not preferable, but it is a precursor to NAD, to NAD plus. Niacinamide is probably the cheapest and most widely available precursor to NAD plus, and it does not cause a flush reaction. Like I mentioned, another way, probably the proper way without taking any supplements to increase the levels of NAD plus is simply by stimulating the oxidation of NADH, which is the reduced version, back into NAD+, and that happens by raising the metabolic rate. That can happen by taking thyroid, the active version, T4. That can happen by taking anti-cortisol medication or steroids or other substances that inhibit the synthesis of cortisol or block its effects at the receptor level. That can happen by taking oxidizing agents such as quinones, or in other words, things that can actually directly act like oxygen and oxidize a molecule that's reduced, such as NADH. Methylene blue is a very popular one. Coenzyme Q10 is another one. It's also a essential cofactor in our metabolic machinery. Vitamin K, which is a naphthoquinone, is another good one. The tetracycline antibiotics, they're all quinones. They're very similar to vitamin K in structure. They're also capable of shifting the redox balance toward oxidation. Aspirin is another one. Even though aspirin is, when you look at the molecule, it's not a quinone molecule, in the body it can get metabolized to an orthoquinone, 1,2 orthobenzoquinone. And basically, it's a very potent oxidizing agent that can oxidize NADH back into NAD+. It's really a variety of mechanisms here, but the key message is that if you're eating predominantly fat, you're not eating sufficient amount of carbohydrates, while you will be getting some benefits initially, mostly due to drop of excess, I mean, you're going to drop some weight because of loss of water that may improve your blood pressure, but it's not going to really change the long-term loss of fat, which is really important for your cardiovascular disease profile. And then if you continue this over, let's say, 6 or 9 months or more, you're going to start seeing some structural changes in all likelihood that are not beneficial, even if you're eating predominantly saturated fat as part of a ketogenic diet. And there are ways to reverse those changes by, taking some of the steps that I mentioned.
Okay. So if you had a patient come in who was maybe 50 or 60 pounds overweight, had high insulin, maybe even PCOS looking, not having monthly cycles, appeared to be just highly insulin resistant, would your approach be some of these supplements you just recommended, plus gaining, doing some resistance training and then eating consistent glucose?
So I view the specifically diabetes type 2 and insulin resistance and the whole metabolic syndrome spectrum, I view them as an endocrine disorder. I think a lot of doctors would agree. But for some reason, cortisol is not getting the attention that's really needed. A lot of doctors will recommend complete avoidance of carbs to people with insulin resistance, and especially type 2 diabetes, despite the fact that even medical books state that 80% of the blood glucose, of the elevated blood glucose seen in the blood of a diabetic or obese or insulin resistant patient is non-dietary of origin. In other words, it's produced by the body, and the main source of that is the process of gluconeogenesis, and the most potent driver of the process is the hormone cortisol. So conversely, if that hypothesis is correct, in other words, if our elevated blood glucose in a diabetic patient or obese patient or a PCOS patient is driven by cortisol, you would expect administering an anti-cortisol medication to have really beneficial effects. And that has been the case. There is a drug on the market already approved for a different reason. It's known as the abortion pill. Its code name is RU486, also known as mifepristone. And it's currently marketed as the abortion pill simply because the market share for selling the drug is much bigger. But the drug was designed by the French company Sanofi back in the 80s as a cortisol antagonist. They just simply realized that the market for that drug was very small because at the time, actually to this day, the market for cortisol antagonists is mostly people with so-called Cushing syndrome or Cushing disease. It's a very rare disease or very, very rare syndrome. However, if you look at all of the people that have the sort of called central obesity, metabolic syndrome, insulin type of diabetes, they're all on the spectrum of Cushing. They all have central obesity. They all have loss of mass in the extremities, in the peripheral, in the arms and legs. And in a very extreme version, they look like the lemon with stick model. In other words, all the mass is concentrated in the center. And basically, they have very thin arms and legs with no muscle and no fat on them either. And that's really what cortisol does. It drives the concentration it drives the storage of fat towards the center, towards to create visceral fat, which is really the fat that's been shown to be the most highly correlated with cardiovascular disease. So if a person comes to me with these symptoms, I would suspect elevated cortisol, and not only elevated cortisol, but also much more importantly, actually, is the ratio of cortisol to some of the anti-cortisol hormones that men and women produce. Several studies have been published demonstrated that not a single person with obesity or diabetes was found where for males where the cortisol to testosterone ratio was below 10. In other words, cortisol was outnumbering testosterone in obese or generally in healthy males in a ratio of at least 10 to 1. And the ones with cortisol to testosterone ratio of 30 to 1 or above were all diabetic. So testosterone has an anti-cortisol effect. It's probably the primary anti-cortisol blocker in healthy young males. Another anti-cortisol hormone is DHEA. There is, of course, the cortisol to DHEA ratio. So cortisol to DHEA ratio has recently been proposed as the most reliable long-term predictor of both all-cause mortality and morbidity. So it's like it's really like the if you test one thing, you better test these two hormones and calculate the ratio. And the ratio should be in favor of DHEA. In other words, you should be producing more DHEA than cortisol. Because if you're not, if the ratio of cortisol to DHEA is actually not even above one, if it's above 0.5, in other words, DHEA is still predominating. But if the cortisol is basically levels of the cortisol you're producing is about half of what the amount of DHEA you're producing, you're already in trouble. Multiple studies have demonstrated that people with severe clinical depression have cortisol to DHEA ratios above 0.5, without a single exception. Above one can lead to psychosis. People with cardiovascular disease, not a single one of them was shown to have a cortisol to DHEA ratio less than 0.5. The ones with over one usually had a heart attacks, often repeated ones. Same with strokes, same with cancer, same with immune dysfunctions, including HIV. In fact, there was a study back in the, I think, the early 90s that attempted to treat HIV patients with an androgen, male patients, the androgen dihydrotestosterone, because that androgen is also an anti-cortisol molecule, right? So it can serve to kind of shift the ratio. Instead of looking at cortisol to testosterone for males, we can also look at cortisol to dihydrotestosterone, and it's still a good metric because dihydrotestosterone is still opposing cortisol. So another way to look at it is that HIV, which is a viral disease, is actually caused by excessive, or at least driven by a lot of its pathology, is driven by an unopposed cortisol, at least a hormonal profile heavily in favor of cortisol. Same thing has been noticed for PCOS in women. Same thing, in other words, the cortisol to testosterone, the cortisol to DHEA ratio has been elevated or above or higher than optimal in every chronic disease tested so far. And also infectious diseases. The recent pandemic demonstrated that people who had the highest risk of hospitalization and mortality had the lowest levels of DHEA. So it was an association study. It didn't prove causality, but it does corroborate the theory. And because we know that cortisol is an immune suppressant, DHEA is an anti-cortisol. It's also known to be an immune booster. So it's expected that if you have a low DHEA levels, and cortisol levels almost never decline because you'll die if they would, if you have Addison disease and it's not treated. So in other words, if your DHEA levels decline, cortisol levels will remain unopposed, and you're going to be in a chronic catabolic state, even if your cortisol levels are in range. And I think that's what's throwing off most doctors. If an obese or generally unhealthy patient goes to the doctor, has some clearly metabolic condition, the doctor will say, sometimes we'll check the steroids, but then cortisol will come back normal. DHEA may come back, close to the lower range of normal. But if you calculate the ratio will be way above where it needs to be in order for proper, oxidation of glucose. And multiple intervention studies have demonstrated given either anti-cortisol medication, such as RU486, or DHEA, and potentially both, actually almost immediately reverses the elevated blood glucose and the insulin resistance, and over time leads not only to weight loss, but sustained weight loss without any dieting. So to me, that's really strong evidence that what we see is these metabolic conditions are primarily endocrine in origin, and they need to be treated as such. So if a person is very, very obese or has trouble maintaining their weight, perhaps one of the worst things you can do is because their cortisol to DHEA levels will already be higher than optimal, you don't want to put in traditional stress like they did in The Biggest Loser, and put them into even more stress, more dieting, more restriction, because the cortisol to DHEA levels will skyrocket even more. Yeah. So yes, while you're torturing them, they will be losing the weight. But when you stop, they will be in a really bad situation, because then the catabolic to anti-catabolic sort of ratio in their body systemically will be really skewed in favor of catabolism for muscle, but cortisol is anabolic for fat. It's catabolic for muscle. It's anabolic for fat. There is so if you want to lose weight, ultimately cortisol needs to be taken under control, even if whether it's elevated absolutely in terms of above the normal range or relatively by comparing its levels to the levels of the anti-cortisol hormones such as DHEA in both sexes and androgens such as testosterone and the hydrotestosterone specifically in men.
Yeah. Wow. I couldn't have said it better myself, Georgie.
Thank you.
So I'm going to summarize. Cortisol is bad. Cortisol is the enemy. It's the
Chronic elevated cortisol.
Yeah, chronic elevated cortisol. Right. You need to mount a cortisol response in an acute situation. You know, you run out in the street to grab your kid who's wandering in the street about to get run over by a car. You get a big infection. You get COVID. You need to mount a response to that. So we need this acute put out the germ or you know, respond to the acute stress. But chronic cortisol is the enemy. Chronic low carb is going to drive that cortisol up. We don't have time to go into this, Georgie. We're up against the end of the show, but I just want to throw out there, because I've had a few patients do this. They start dabbling in this a little bit, or they sniff. They get wind that sugar's not all bad if it's a natural sugar, especially like fruit and honey, and they start doing some of that. But they're so used to eating so much fat. So when they remain in a high fat intake and start adding in the sugar, because you have all that fat there, you're blocking the ability to burn that sugar appropriately, and that causes trouble. So you've got to bring the fat down, actually. So initially, if you want to go keto, low carb for some initial few days, weeks, whatever, but the long term, you want to bring in the sugar and you want to bring down the fat in a nutshell. Is that right, Georgie?
Yes, and avoid chronic stress and basically test your hormonal profile with your doctor. Very important. Yep. And ask for several of these hormones, specifically to calculate the catabolic response, which is mostly driven by cortisol, estrogen in some cases as well, but let's focus to keep it simple. Cortisol to DHEA ratio in both sexes and in all age groups, the most reliable universal predictor of both mortality and morbidity. And if that ratio is higher than 0.5, then it usually means that you know, something in your lifestyle or in your diet needs to change, because this is not good for you in the long run.
Yep. Awesome. Well, thank you, Georgie. Really, really appreciate all your insights, all your hard work. I know this is a little anti what most kind of holistic doctors, natural doctors are doing. One more time, Twitter handle and best place to follow you.
Yes, twitter.com/heydude, and also heydude.me is the blog. And if you want to engage with me, I do my best to respond on people commenting on the articles on Twitter.
Okay, awesome. Okay, everybody, this show will be recorded and put on iTunes under You're the Cure. Also, it's on our website, veritasmedical.com, under the resource tab, podcast archive page. Send it to all your friends who want the truth. Appreciate y'all listening. We'll be back next week with another great show. Thank you, Georgie.
Thanks so much for inviting me. I hope you listeners find it useful.
All right. We'll see you next time, everybody. This is Dr. Ben Edwards, You're the Cure.